For our first session this afternoon, Brother Roger Lewis has entitled it Bold Initiatives for Benedict XVI. Who precisely is the false prophet? Muhammad or the papacy? And now I call Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman. And shall I put you out of your misery straight from the start by giving you a subtle clue as to who I think the false prophet might be, as we shall see in the unfolding of our first address this afternoon. Actually, it's quite good, really, don't you think, the planning of the committee to sort of have two studies and collapse for lunch, and then two studies and collapse for tea, and then two studies and just collapse. And hopefully by having those breaks we'll be able to focus long enough for each of those two sessions to take in the message. And you'll notice how that in a sense this study follows on from the last one, which began with a different view as to the matter of the building of a temple, that perhaps another temple would be built by the Jews and that the man of sin would come and sit in that temple in Jerusalem. And you'll see how that when we have a framework of Bible prophecy to work against and with, well, we're able to test those views and see where they might fit or where they might not fit on that prophetic framework. Well, I guess this study's somewhat the same in this respect, that if you come to Revelation chapter 16, this particular lecture or study is based, again, on a slightly different view of who the false prophet might be. And in Revelation chapter 16, we're told this in the 13th verse. The record says, "And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet." And so the question, of course, is, as is a reasonable one to raise, is, well, who is this false prophet? Is it possibly Muhammad and the power of Islam? And that's certainly been promoted as an option. And by the way, the line of argument is something along these lines, which is that because the false prophet is introduced for the very first time in this chapter, in Revelation chapter 16 and verse 13, that, well, perhaps this is a new term that indicates some new entity, some new force entering into onto the theatre of the scene of the book of Revelation, and that perhaps that new entity is none other than the power of Islam. In fact, what's suggested is that when it says the dragon in verse 13, that the dragon is perhaps the Eastern Orthodox Church, and that when it says the beast, that that's Roman Catholicism, and that when it says the false prophet, that that's the power of Islam. And we've got these three great world religions gathered together at the time of the end in opposition, you see. So the question is, well, how does that fit the framework? Can we make sense of that idea? Or is there a better and more satisfying biblical explanation? And by the way, perhaps just attached to that idea of the false prophet is this, and it is quite interesting, that there are five pillars of Islam. And the first of the five pillars of Islam, known as the Shahada, is something that every true Muslim must be able to both recite and believe. It's like their statement of faith. And the statement of faith of all Muslims is, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. And so people say, well, there you are, you see, he's a false prophet. He's the great rival system. And that maybe this new idea of the false prophet occurs in Revelation 16 to indicate this new power coming into the sequence of events in the latter days. I've got several problems with that, but here's the first one. The first one is that the role of Muhammad and the power of Islam has already been revealed in the book of Revelation. And we're not going to turn it up today, but the power of Islam is referred to in that chapter as locusts and scorpions. And in fact, one of the marvellous things about Revelation 9 is the absolute precision of how it traces the rise of the power of Islam for a period of well nigh 300 years with absolute precision, charting the destiny and the history of that particular power in their execution of divine judgment upon the Eastern Roman Empire. The power of Muhammad and the Islam, the Islamic faith, has already been mentioned in the book of Revelation. So in fact, the real question about Revelation 16 would be, well, you'd have to explain why a new symbol is now needed to identify the same Islamic influence that's already been introduced in the book of Revelation earlier. Now, by the way, just so that you know, we're being absolutely and scrupulously fair, we've got to explain, in any event, why the false prophet, whoever he is introduced in Revelation chapter 16, and why at that particular moment of time, which we'll come to shortly. And when we do, I think you'll find that a much more satisfying explanation exists, for which there is no explanation with regard to the power of Islam. So Islam has already been revealed, and this is therefore the suggestion that it's the false prophet of chapter 16 only begs another question as to why the symbol would have changed. And I've got another problem as well, and that's in Acts chapter 20. If you come to Acts chapter 20, I should just rephrase that, shouldn't I? I have another problem with regard to the suggestion that the false prophet is Islam. That's slightly clearer than simply saying, I have another problem. Which no doubt is true, but I'm not here to talk about those particular problems with you today. Now, in Acts chapter 20, do you see what Paul says in verse 28? He says, take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over which the Holy Spirit hath made you overseer, to feed the ecclesia of God, which he hath purchased with his own blood. For I know this, he says, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. And also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them. So the apostle warned that there would be the danger of people coming into the ecclesia, well, prophecies about false prophets. So here's Paul's warning. He says, I know this, that after my departing, they shall enter in among you, and of your own selves shall those particular people arise. So where were they to come from? Why, what? From within the midst of the community of the believers. Now, I believe that the apostle's words on this occasion are an allusion to the Lord's words in Matthew 7, when the Lord said, beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing. Paul says, not sparing the flock. But inwardly, says the Lord, they are ravening wolves. Paul says, they're grievous wolves. So I think the very men that Paul warned about in Acts 20 were the false prophets that Jesus warned about in Matthew chapter 7. So where do they come from? From among the community of the believers. And not just Paul, but also Peter. Because if you come to the second epistle of Peter, we're told this in 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 says, and reading from verse 1, but there were false prophets also among the people, even as there shall be false teachers among you, who privily shall bring in damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them, and bring upon themselves swift destruction. And many shall follow their pernicious ways, by reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of. And so Peter warns that there would be false prophets arise, you see, as there were in the Old Testament times, so there would be in the New. But do you notice where the false prophets come from? There were false prophets among the people, and there shall be false teachers among you, says Peter. That's where they come from. And as with Peter, and as with Paul, so also with John, because John will say this in the first of John chapter 4, Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God, and this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye hear that it should come. He says, many false prophets are gone out into the world, but the question is, where did they go out from? And the answer is that chapter 2 says they went out from us. They were not of us, for if they had been of us, they would no doubt have continued with us. So to a man, the testimony, the false prophets of John's warning and of Peter's warning and of Paul's warning is of people that would arise from within and among the community of the believers. The testimony of these apostles is that that's where these false prophets would come from within the ecclesia itself. And I think that that's one of the main reasons why Muhammad doesn't qualify as the false prophet of the book of Revelation. Because, brothers and sisters, Muhammad never came from Christendom. He didn't come from the ecclesia. The religion of Islam was never an apostasy from the Christian faith. In fact, it wasn't even about or of the Christian faith whatsoever. It was something totally different. Islam, in fact, was a clumsy mixture of many things, but the one thing it most certainly was not was the leadership of a teacher who started off amongst the believers of the truth, which is what Peter said would happen, and Paul, and John. That's what where they said the false prophets would come from. So whoever the false prophet might be, and bear in mind we haven't said yet, but the one thing I think we can say is he can't be Muhammad. He didn't come from amongst the community. Yet that's where he was supposed to come from, according to the apostles. Oh, and by the way, you'd never guess, would you, brothers and sisters, who first propounded the notion that Muhammad might be the false prophet? Why, the Roman Catholic Church. Surprise, surprise. Because you see, as part of the Counter-Reformation, when the Roman Church was under attack in terms of people seeing the fulfillment of prophecy concerning that great apostate system, the Counter-Reformation, led by certain Jesuits, said, we've got to suggest something else. And so they said, no, what about him over there? Muhammad's the false prophet. And the first suggestion of that idea came from a Jesuit Roman Catholic teacher. In fact, the very fact that it was first suggested by the Roman Catholics would probably make you very suspicious, wouldn't it, in terms of the credibility of that idea? And so when we have that within the community, brothers and sisters, it becomes a matter of concern. Because I don't think it's soundly reasoned, biblically. It's again a clutching at straws. Someone says, what about this? Perhaps the false prophet is Islam. And people say, what a wonderful idea. Perhaps it is. Perhaps it might be. But they've got no framework to test it against. Well, you've got to. So let's have a look at the references that are in existence about the false prophet. Because the strange thing is, there's only three of them. So there's not a lot. And the first one's in Revelation chapter 16. Let's go back to that and just read them carefully, and then having read each one of them, we're going to look at what these particular passages might teach about identifying the false prophet of this book. So here's the first one again in Revelation 16. Do you remember verse 13? I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles to go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world, to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. That's the first time the false prophet occurs. First of three times. Here's the second one. It's in Revelation chapter 19 and verses 20 and 21. Revelation 19, verses 20 and 21. It says there, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone, and the remnant was slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceeded out of his mouth, and all the fowls were filled with their flesh. That's the second passage. Here's the third, chapter 20 of Revelation, verses 9 and 10. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. So we haven't got a lot, have we? Just these three brief references about the false prophet. And out of these references, brothers and sisters, we've got to fashion some decision biblically as to who the false prophet might be of these passages. So come back to chapter 16, and let me just walk you through some identifying marks. And I think, brothers and sisters, that as we do this, that you'll be absolutely convinced that again, our framework of Bible prophecy holds true and gives us an excellent explanation of who the false prophet might be. So here's the first identifying mark or characteristic. Strange one, actually. Revelation 16, verse 13 says that the false prophet appears at the time of the vile judgments on Europe during the 19th century. Now, if you don't know much about Revelation 16, let me just give you the dates. These are just a brief summation. Verse 2 of Revelation 16 says, "The first angel went and poured out his vial upon the earth." Now, that was about 1790 in terms of time. And then verse 3 says, "The second angel poured out his vial upon the sea," which was about 1795. Verse 4 says, "The third angel poured out his vial upon the rivers," which was about 1796. Verse 8 says, "The fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun," which was about 1806. And verse 10 says, "The fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast," which was about 1809. And verse 12 says, "The sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates," which began in about 1820. Now, again, we haven't got time to digress into the vials of Revelation 16, but it's most astonishing how accurately the Spirit was able to foreshadow the work of Napoleon in bringing judgments upon Europe at that remarkable time in the history of the world. Some of the most exciting stories are the stories of the vile judgments of Revelation chapter 16, running right into the heart of the 1800s, the middle of the 19th century. Now, here's the really strange thing. Verse 13, "I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet." First time the false prophet's mentioned. Now, here's the question, brothers and sisters. Why do you think it is that the false prophet is mentioned for the first time in the middle of the 19th century concerning the vile judgments to be poured out in Europe? And an even better question is, how would you apply that to the power of Islam as the false prophet and give a good explanation as to why he turns up in the middle of the 19th century? Well, I've never heard an explanation about that because I don't think there is one. But there just happens to be a fascinating explanation if the false prophet is the papacy. Because in the year 1870, something disastrous happened as far as the papacy was concerned. Something disastrous and something remarkable. What was the disastrous thing that happened to the papacy in 1870? In 1870, Garibaldi marched through Italy and unified Italy, and as a result, the Pope lost all his temporal dominions, all his land that created revenue, all the states that made him, by the way, the image of the beast, all stripped, gone. The Pope was left a virtual prisoner in the Vatican. It was one of the worst disasters to befall the papacy and all the power and pride of its prestige down through the centuries. And in that same year, 1870, the Jesuits, led by their black pope, launched a reformation that was to revive the power of the papacy and make it the greatest living force, or the greatest force in living history. And they did it in the same year. And what did they do? What did the Jesuits do? They said, let's develop the doctrine of papal infallibility. Actually, quite interesting what happened. You probably know. But that cardinal assembly assembled in the palace, and the pontiff sat upon that special chair, and the cardinal in charge unfolded the proclamation of papal infallibility that he might read it to the assembled cardinals. And at the time that he declared the papal infallibility, a mighty thunderstorm roared overhead across the city of all Rome, so that the cardinals couldn't hear the proclamation being uttered of Catholic infallibility out of the mouth of the Pope, as if nature itself frowned on the wickedness of the spectacle. And at that moment, brothers and sisters, smack in the middle of the 19th century in the vile judgments, the Pope of Rome became preeminently the false prophet by virtue of his claim of infallibility. I think that's a very good explanation. Never heard a word about how that might fit with Islam, because it doesn't. And here's another one. It says in Revelation 16 that this speaking mouth comes out of the mouth of the false prophet. And clearly what we're being told is that this man represents a system of religion with teaching authority vested uniquely in one man. Because after all, you remember what Peter and Paul and John had said? They warned about what? They warned about the fact that false prophets would come. But Revelation 16 doesn't say false prophets. It says the false prophet, singular. Ah, so what we're looking for is one man who's at the very apex of a religious system with all teaching authority vested in what comes out of his mouth. That's the papacy, is it not? Let me read you an interesting extract from a book called A Short Introduction to Islam. You can buy this, by the way, from the Christadelphian office. It's got a series of little books that are a short introduction to other religions. This is the one about Islam. Page 9, it says this. There is no church in Islam, no formally constituted body empowered to supervise or to dictate the religious agenda, or to articulate an official Islamic view comparable to that of the papacy. In other words, brothers and sisters, there's no one at the top of Islam, one man with absolute teaching authority. That's not how Islam works. Islam has a multitude of teachers, of ulama, of imam. There isn't one man. Yet the false prophet is manifestly a system of religion vested uniquely in this one person that opens his mouth. Oh, and by the way, when he opens his mouth, what do we hear? What we hear is the demonic spirit of liberty, equality, and fraternity, the frog-like spirits, come out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now, what's really interesting about papal encyclicals, if you follow papal encyclicals down through time, you'll find that the Roman Catholic Church has always been very adept at somehow issuing proclamations that are right on the button of the current mood of social thinking. Even though that social thinking might be changing somehow, mysteriously, incrementally, gradually, the Church moves so that when the Pope utters his encyclicals, he's always in tune with modern thinking, you see. And when it suits the papacy, those encyclicals will proclaim the spirits of liberty, equality, and fraternity for the good of the church, that its power might be increased. Well, you will never hear that spirit out of the mouth of Islam. Islam has never spoken with the spirit of equality or of liberty or of fraternity. That's not how Islam works. Islam is intolerant of other religions. Islam demands subservience to its own faith. Do you know something interesting? Just recently, Saudi Arabia completed the building of a $65 million Arabic mosque in Rome. The city of Rome. Imagine if we went to Mecca and said, we'd like to build a $65 million Christian church here. I can tell you now what the answer would be. You'd be shot. And they take your deposit as well. You see, Islam would never tolerate that sort of thing. Wherever Muslims go, they demand their rights, but are not prepared to grant those rights in reverse to other people living in Muslim countries. Because, as a faith, Islam doesn't preach liberty, it's intolerant of other religions, it seeks to dominate the world with Islamic faith. It is not the mouth of the frog-like spirit, and yet the false prophet does. And here's another point. It says this, that what's interesting about this particular false prophet is that the voice he speaks and the things he says, verse 14, are the spirits of devils working miracles which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to battle. Now, you see that word world, that's the Greek word oikumene, which, by the way, means essentially the Roman world of the day and, in effect, the European continent. So whoever the false prophet is, he's able to incite the kings of the European continent to come together to battle. Question. How does Islam fulfill that idea of having special power over the leaders of Europe to gather Europe together? Question. Has the papacy ever had influence over the kings of the oikumene? And the answer is that when the popes have spoken and the popes have cried, the kings and queens of Europe have gathered together for the last 1,000 years of history. The pope can call those people together, the kings of the oikumene. Just look at the pictures of who was there at the time of the death of John Paul II, and you'll see all the kings and queens of the Roman world gathered together, because the papacy's always been able to gather those ones together. That's where he operates from. And as with that, come on, have a look at Revelation chapter 19. So just two or three more points of identification. And the first one is this. In Revelation 19, it says that he's able to perform signs and wonders, because verse 20 says, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles. Ah, so the false prophet can actually, he can practice miracles, can he? Well, do you know that that's something you never heard or you never hear of with regard to the power of Islam? The Muslims don't really perform miracles. But guess who does? Guess what religion is famous for its miracles, its images, its shrines, its relics, its saints? Guess which church has a feather from the wing of an angel? Guess which church has enough splinters from the cross scattered through the Roman Catholic churches, which when brought together would be capable of building a ship? Guess which church has wonderful statues that could weep tears or gush blood? Any miracle you like, as long as people pay their money and as long as the will of the people are bowed in subservient obedience to the power of the church. Oh yes, the Roman Catholic system has long practiced miracles, has it not? To bind the heart and soul of the believers to them. Never hear that with Islam. It's not a characteristic feature of the Islamic faith. It is of the papacy. Always has been. And coupled with that is this, that it specifically says in Revelation 19 that he deceives those who had received the mark of the beast by means of his miracles. Now the mark of the beast, well, where does the beast live, by the way? We're going to come to that in one of our studies. Where does the beast live? And the answer is the beast lives in Europe. We're going to look at that in our study after the evening meal. So the mark of the beast is associated with something that's engraven on the thinking of European people. Question: how does the power of Islam particularly deceive those associated with the European system? And the answer is, well, we're not sure. But, well, I don't know, anyone travel here to Europe recently? Last 12 months? Oh, it's time we did some overseas travel, isn't it? We need to break out of Virginia and find the rest of the world. Well, you know, it's a really remarkable thing. If you go to Europe, it's absolutely astonishing. You drive through little villages, and you come round a corner, and there'll be a picture of Mary painted on the wall of a house, and a little niche over there with a statue of Mary, and a little statue in the middle of the village. And wherever you go, the mark of the papacy is everywhere throughout the face of the continent of Europe. You're never allowed to forget it. Wherever you go, the mark of the papacy is there. You see, the papacy actually lives in this area and is particularly powerful in deceiving people. This is the sphere of the false prophet's influence. In fact, it goes on to say that he seeks to influence all of these, says verse 20, so that they might worship the image of the beast. Now, by the way, the image of the beast is a title that really has to do with the whole apparatus of the Roman Catholic Church system. In the days that it was so powerful, it was like a kingdom in its own regard. So the question is, why would the false prophet, if he was Muhammad, want to cause people to worship the Roman Catholic system, which is the image of the beast? The answer is, well, I'm not quite sure why Muhammad would want to do that. But I know exactly why the false prophet, if he's the papacy, would want to bow people down to subscribe to the power of the Roman Catholic apparatus of government, because the two go hand in hand, don't they? And so, of course, if you want to have a different interpretation of the false prophet, you've now got to have a subsequent different interpretation of the image of the beast as well, because otherwise it won't fit together. And here's one last thought, a good one, actually. In Revelation 16, it says, I saw that unclean spirit coming out of the mouth of the dragon, the mouth of the beast, the mouth of the false prophet. False prophet and beast. In Revelation chapter 20, it says, verse 20, and the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet. Sorry, that's Revelation 19. In Revelation chapter 20, it says, and the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of the fire, where the beast and the false prophet are. The false prophet is always, without exception, always associated with, in fact, the beast. He suffers the same judgment at the same time. And, of course, the beast is centered in Europe. So the question is, how is Islam uniquely associated with the beast system of Europe? How is the papacy associated with the beast system of Europe? And to ask those two questions is probably, brothers and sisters, to give the answer. And by the way, there's another thing to remember, is that this false prophet, of course, as we've seen in our framework of Bible prophecy, this false prophet doesn't occur in isolation. It's not as if he pops up in Revelation 16 and that somehow he's got nothing to do with anything that's gone before. Isn't the whole power of that prophetic framework the fact that it's a continuous story down through time, and the false prophet will be part of that continuous story? Well, let me show you something interesting. Because, you see, I think the original false prophet was none other than Nimrod himself. Here's an extract from, again, The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. He says, Pharaonius lived about the time when mankind was scattered abroad. He is said to have been the first that gathered mankind into communities, the first of mortals that reigned, and the first that offered idolatrous sacrifices. Now, by the way, do you remember what Genesis 10 said? And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Who was the first of men to establish a kingdom? Why, Nimrod. Who was the first of men to reign over others, to gather them together? Why, Nimrod. And so the suggestion here is that that character, the character of Pharaonius, can agree with none other than Nimrod, who wasn't just the first to reign, but as the record says here, was the first to offer idolatrous sacrifices. Now, the name given to him in connection with offering idolatrous sacrifices is very significant. Pharaonius, in one of its meanings, and that of the most natural, signifies the apostate. That name had very likely been given him by the uninfected portion of the sons of Noah. All tradition from the earliest time bears testimony to the apostasy of Nimrod and his success in leading men away from the patriarchal faith. By the way, did Nimrod act as a false prophet from within? Yes. And then move without and take people with him? Yes. Just like the latter-day false prophet. So what we propose is that the false prophet of the book of Revelation is none other than the latter-day manifestation of that old Nimrodian spirit who was the first of the false prophets to apostatize from God's truth, from the seed of the woman, from the blue line. And that in fact the false prophet is the final champion of the seed of the serpent. And so that story that begins with Nimrod and Shem is going to end up with the false prophet and the faithful and true at the time of the end in accordance with these particular requirements of Bible prophecy. So the false prophet is the last stage in a long story and the last leader in a long line. And he's not the power of Islam. He's clearly the papacy down through time, the inheritor of the mantle of Nimrod. Now, what's interesting about all of that, brothers and sisters, is that having established that a much more satisfactory biblical definition of the false prophet is, in fact, the papacy, because bear in mind, we've already seen, haven't we, that didn't the papacy become Babylon phase two? Wasn't the Babylonish system of priesthood transferred to Rome? Didn't the man of sin appear in a temple there? And the false prophet is simply another word or another expression for that same story. So Islam and Muhammad can't be the false prophet. The papacy is. And now those same references in the book of Revelation become interesting for us in the context of what we might expect in terms of future developments. Now, most of you will know that when a pope comes to office, he chooses a name that will describe his pontificate. He chooses his name carefully because he wants it to be symbolic of what his reign will be about, what his leadership will be about as the Pope of Rome. And when Joseph Ratzinger was made the pope, they said to him, "Well, why have you chosen this particular name?" And this is what he said. This is the very first time that Benedict gave a public audience. When asked why he chose the name Benedict for his pontificate, Joseph Ratzinger replied as follows. He said, "Well," he said, "St. Benedict lived at a time when the Roman Empire was collapsing, and he saw the role of the church as to preserve the best in human culture throughout the centuries. The whole world was crumbling, and Benedict helped ensure that civilization survived. He constitutes a fundamental point of reference for the unity of Europe and a powerful call to the irrefutable Christian roots of European culture and civilization." So, St. Benedict, born 480 AD, what happened was he thought that Europe was basically becoming uncivilized, becoming barbarian. So he withdrew into a monastery, took his followers, and said, "We've got to save the planet. Well, if not the planet, let's see if we can save Europe." So when the whole of European civilization was crumbling from the onslaught of the barbarians, Benedict saved the world of his day in terms of thought. So along comes Ratzinger and says, "This is the name that I want to be called." By the way, he's not the first one, he's Benedict the 16th, so he's not the first chap who's had the idea of that name, but it's what he wants to be known for. And by the way, what happened in the year 1980 is that John Paul II declared Saint Benedict to be the patron saint of Europe. Of course, 1980 was the 1500th celebration of the birth of Saint Benedict. And so in 1980, John Paul II made Saint Benedict the patron saint of Europe. And along comes Ratzinger and says, "This is the name that I want to have. My work will be to save Europe." I believe that that's what he's about. He's a man of destiny in that regard. Do you know that for many years, Ratzinger took an annual retreat, an annual private retreat, to refocus himself. And he went to a Benedictine monastery. For year after year after year, a Benedictine monastery is where he went to. In fact, do you know that on the night before John Paul II died, Joseph Ratzinger disappeared out of the Vatican. He slipped away to a little village in Italy called Subiaco. And he went there because he'd been asked to go for a presentation. Because in that particular place, it's only a little village really, but it's got a cave, you see. And the cave of Subiaco is where St. Benedict had his first vision. And there's a Benedictine monastery there to this very day. And the abbot of the monastery had asked Joseph Ratzinger to come into the village that night to receive an award. An award that recognized the important contribution that Ratzinger had made with regard to, well, promoting a particular man. And the award that Joseph was given on that night was the Premia San Benedetto, which means the Saint Benedict Award. And he was given that award because of his understanding of the role that Saint Benedict played, and he stood up at Subiaco that night And he gave a speech on the importance of Saint Benedict in the history of Europe. And he went back to the Vatican. And the next morning, John Paul II died. And Joseph Ratzinger was plunged into the round of elections that would elect him Pope. And when the Cardinal said, "What name do you wish to take?" he said, "I shall be called Benedict." Mark my words, brothers and sisters, this man is on a mission. He's 80 years old already. He's got epic ambition, it is said of him. And he's on a mission to recover Europe in that sense. Let me show you the coat of arms of Joseph Ratzinger, Benedict XVI. There's something intriguing about the coat of arms. Actually, several intriguing things. You see how there's a red shield in the middle? And on the red shield, hanging on either side, are a sort of like what's called a yellow or a gold mantle. Can you see the mantle on either side? Draped across the shield, just the gold mantle. Ignore the things inside the mantle, just the gold mantle. Those gold mantles are the symbol of the Benedictine order. They're part of Ratzinger's personal crest or coat of arms. The mantles of the Benedictine monastic order. He's a Benedictine through and through in terms of his thinking. On the two mantles, on the one side is what's described as a Moor's head from Africa, and on the other side, a bear. And those two things are quite interesting because the Moor's head is a symbol of Saint Corbinian from the Diocese of Freising in Germany. Now, why that's interesting is because Freising was the very first place where Joseph Ratzinger ever had a job. He taught there. He lectured in theology at Freising. And he took the motto or the symbol of Saint Corbinian of Freising in Germany and put it on his own personal coat of arms. And the bear is known as the bear of Saint Corbinian. And the story goes that one day Saint Corbinian was travelling to Rome and this bear came and attacked his horse and killed it. And Saint Corbinian turned and commanded the bear to bear his load, to carry his load, no pun intended. And the bear carried the load of Saint Benedict until he got to Rome, and at that stage Saint Corbinian released the bear that returned, well, back to Bavaria, actually. And the symbol of the legend was that he, Saint Corbinian, as representative of the Catholic Church, had the power to tame the pagan powers of Europe, represented by the bear. That's the symbol on Benedict's personal shield. Now, the really interesting bit is the bit at the top and the bit at the bottom, because neither of those are pieces that should normally be appended to the papal coat of arms. At the top, the papal coat of arms normally has what's called the Pope's tiara. That is not the Pope's tiara. That, at the top, is a bishop's mitre. And the bishop's mitre is indicative of the fact that he is a teacher. And down the bottom, the little white thing hanging off the bottom, is a wool pallium. And the wool pallium, which is a bishop's pallium, is indicative of the fact that he's a pastor of the flock. And what Benedict is saying is, he's not going to win Europe by battle of arms. He's not going to redeem Europe by means of any other means, that he's going to be the teacher and the pastor of his flock. But mark my words, his mission is to recover Europe for the papacy, and that's fully what he intends to do. He's a man on a mission to do just that. The bold initiatives of Benedict XVI is that he's going to turn Europe thoroughly Roman Catholic again. He's going to win them back by the power of his message. You know, one of the American cardinals was asked when he was about to jump on the plane to travel home after the conclave that elected Benedict. One of the American cardinals, I can't remember which one, was asked, "Why do you think that you've elected this man, Joseph Ratzinger?" And he said this. It was actually quite an insightful comment. He said, "Well, when we elected John Paul II, we were facing a crisis of the church in the East," by which of course he meant the power of Russia and the threats in Poland and what was going on in Eastern Europe. We elected John Paul II because of a crisis in the East. But he said, "We've elected this man because of a crisis in the West." That's what he said. And the reason why he said that, and the reason that he meant by that, was that during all these years, where John Paul II has been travelling as a global pope to the astonishment of all the world, the numbers of Catholics in Europe has been declining. This man is about to stop that decline. He's been elected by the cardinals to recover Europe for the church, and that is his full intention. He's a man who understands European culture and the European mind. He's a very, very astute man. He's regarded as the most formidable intellect to have ascended the papal throne for at least a century of time. He's an extremely capable thinker. So, in fact, let's just have a look at that in terms of our biblical expectations then, in terms of one or two things that emerge from that. I think we expect to see the increasing influence of the Pope on European politics, therefore, and in particular regarding the Catholic heritage of European Union. He's going to do that. By the way, you'll remember, of course, that there was a famous lecture that Joseph Ratzinger gave shortly after assuming the papal chair in Regensburg University. Do you remember that lecture? It sort of caused a bit of a flutter around the world because he said something about Islam. Do you remember that? And basically what he said was that Islam is a violent religion. That's how it prosecutes its cause, by violence. And of course, when the Pope said that in his lecture, there was a huge furore of all the Muslims around the world who, by the way, murdered Italian nuns and burned effigies and demolished buildings and showed that they were thoroughly violent. And the Pope said, "I rest my case." Now, let me assure you of this one thing, brothers and sisters. Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, is not George Bush. He doesn't make mistakes with his words. Not this man. That lecture at Regensburg was planned for months. He knew exactly what he was saying and knew exactly why he was saying it. And I can tell you why I believe he was saying it. He was saying it to draw attention to the European community. You cannot let Turkey enter Europe. Because Turkey is Muslim, and they are a different culture and a different faith, and that's not where our roots are. They're a violent lot. Of course, by the way, conveniently overlooking the years of the persecution of the Roman Catholics under the Grand Inquisition, all conveniently forgotten, Islam is a violent religion, he said. And it worked. Because the response of the Muslims has already started to move and to agitate in Europe that maybe they do need to think about how far they go with regard to this. In fact, by the way, you'll probably know, and this was quite interesting, is the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome was celebrated earlier on this year in Germany under the care of Chancellor Angela Merkel. And she invited Benedict to come and address the European Parliament, and he did. And he, you know what he did? It's absolutely remarkable. He castigated the European Parliament, what for? For religious apostasy. Because they had departed from the Catholic roots of what European culture and tradition was all about. And he came up, he came into Germany, and he lambasted the Parliament. Said, "You've got to get back to have some religious basis for what's going on here in terms of the European Union." And that celebration was held on the 25th of March, 2007, because on the 25th of March, 1957, the Treaty of Rome was signed. Where was the Treaty of Rome signed? Why? In what city? The Treaty of Rome. In what palace? The Lateran Palace. Under the watchful eye of a benevolent pope, the leaders, the foreign ministers, was it? Or the presidents, I can't remember, I think the foreign ministers of the six founding member states all signed the Treaty of Rome under the watchful eye of the papacy. And that date wasn't an accident. Because the 25th of March was a feast day to Mary, Our Lady of Europe. And the papacy made sure that the Treaty of Rome was signed on a day that related it to the feasts of the Roman Catholic Church. Yes, I think this man is on a mission and he knows what he's about in terms of what he says. In fact, I think we can expect to see the increasing focus of the Pope on Catholic doctrinal purity to strengthen the faith of church adherents. This man, this false prophet, works miracles to deceive those that have the mark of the beast. That's where he works. That's his focus of intention. I'm going to recover Europe, is what Benedict has said. And by the way, he's gone on record as saying he doesn't mind if the Roman Catholic Church gets smaller. as long as it gets purer and more intense, the battle lines are being shaped. He doesn't mind if the church shrinks. As long as it becomes pure in the process, that's the intention of this particular man moving forward in terms of engaging in that crisis of the West for which he was elected. I think we expect to see the increasing voice of the Pope in promoting Catholic social doctrine by speech and by papal encyclicals. The papacy's always been very adept at doing that and moving along with modern thinking as long as it can be done consistent with the final objectives of the church. You know, brothers and sisters, when we raise children, we say, or we should say, as our children go through the ups and downs of life, think 20 years. I've got these little ones for 20 years. Any little scrape or escapade or something that goes wrong for a day or a week or even a month of their lives is not the end of the world when you've got them for 20 years. When we think ecclesias, how far ahead do we think with ecclesias? Do we think 50 years ahead? Where will our ecclesia be in 50 years? How are we building the foundations for this ecclesia, this light stand, a generation to come? Not here, not now. 50 years. Will it still be there? Will it be strong? Do you know how long the Catholic Church thinks about? It thinks in centuries. And quite a few years ago, I was in Wellington, where I used to live, and there was a man autographing a book in one of the bookstores. The name of the book was In God's Name, and the author was David Yallop. You remember that book, In God's Name? An expose of the mysterious circumstances of the death of John Paul I. If you haven't read it, you should. And so he was there signing books. And this man came up with his book to be signed, who obviously looked Italian, and he stepped forward and spoke to David Yallop, who recognised that he was Italian and spoke to him in Italian. And it turned out that this man had actually remembered John Paul II, because I think he was the Archbishop of Venice, and this man had lived in Venice and remembered him as the Archbishop and knew about his death and had asked for a copy of the book and was getting it signed now by the author. And, you know, when that book was published, this dramatic revelation of the death of a pope who clearly had been done to death by the very members of the Roman Catholic Curia themselves. People said, gasp, this is horrifying. What damage will this do to the Roman Catholic Church? This expose by David Yallop, what will it do to the Roman Catholic Church? And the answer came back, David Yallop, he'll be dead in 100 years. But we shall be there in 1,000. And that's how they think. That's how they work. And this false prophet is thinking in terms of how he will recover the whole of the European system. We expect to see the increasing drive of the Pope to facilitate union with the Eastern Orthodox Rite to create a truly Catholic influence, because he gathers together all the kings of the Oikumene, and the Oikumene straddles both East and West in terms of Eastern and Western Orthodox. Do you know that one of the burning dreams of John Paul II was that he wanted to travel to Moscow. He really, really wanted to make a pilgrimage to Moscow. And someone said, no, you can't come. Who was that? Anyone know? You're not allowed to come. Alexei II, the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. When Joseph Ratzinger was elected, Alexei II, the patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, said, ah, he said, this is a man we can do business with. That's interesting, isn't it? This is a man we can do business with. Oh, and by the way, of course, you do realize that Joseph Ratzinger is a German, and Alexei II is a German. So I think the seeds are being sown right now for evidence of greater rapport between these two sides from the great schism of 1054, and if any pope is able to move it along, it's probably Benedict XVI. We expect to see the increasing power of the pope to position Catholic Europe for the final great controversy, because that's where his sphere of influence is. It always has been in the European continent that the papacy has been seen at its strongest and at its most powerful. So, with regard to that, brothers and sisters, let's just see how important it is for us to be clear on this particular matter. I want you to just take note of these three references. Revelation 14 says, "The smoke of their torment ascends up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name." And then it says, "Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus." I think the clear implication of Revelation chapter 14 is that the faithful ones, the believers, the seed of the woman, the people of the blue line, are in complete opposition to this man of the red line. They've got nothing to do with it. They oppose it. They've never kept that. They've never had that mark. They've stood aside. They're different. This is the patience of the saints. And again, in Revelation chapter 15, it says, "I saw as it were a sea of glass mingled with fire, and them that had gotten the victory over the beast, and over his image, and over his mark, and over the number of his name, and they stood on the sea of glass, having the harps of God." And the clear implication is the saints are those that have stood apart from, stood against this whole system, in fact, that they might gain the victory over it. And lastly, Revelation chapter 20 says, "I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God. But nevertheless, despite that persecution, they had not worshipped the beast, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And these ones, the ones that stood aside, the ones that stood separate, the ones that witnessed against the system, they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. The false prophet is a man of the red line, a champion of the red line. We're supposed to be part of the community of the seed of the woman, who stand aside from such things and have nothing to do with them. What a shame it would be, brothers and sisters, if those of the blue line weren't even able to decide who the false prophet might be, so that they could know who they might oppose. So what it comes down to is this: those associated with the false prophet in this last book receive the mark of the beast. He's trying to mark them. And that mark of the beast is mentioned in Revelation 13 and Revelation 14 and Revelation 20. And each time it's mentioned, of course, you know where the mark is. It's in the forehead. It's a mode of thinking from the seed of the serpent. And those that are associated with the faithful and true, for such is his title, have the seal of God. And that's mentioned in Revelation 7 and Revelation 9 and Revelation 22. And you know where the seal of God is? It's in their forehead. It's a mode of thinking known and practiced and believed and understood by the seed of the woman. And the challenge, therefore, I suppose, of this particular subject is Bible prophecy isn't just about some academic analysis as to who the false prophet might be. It's life and death, that we know where we are and which seed we are of and which mode of thinking we have. Because those whom the false prophet has affected and marked have that mark which dooms them to extinction by God's judgment. And those who have followed the teaching of the faithful and true have the seal that guarantees them immortality by God's mercy. It's life and death to know about these things. What a marvelous thing, brothers and sisters, that our word of prophecy is so clear and so certain and so sure. I think we can have absolutely no doubts as to who the false prophet might be, and it's consistent, isn't it, with our entire framework of Bible prophecy, that final champion of the seed of the serpent power at the time of the end. So let's go forth and declare in our lives that we don't belong to that community, to that system, to that mode of thinking. In the words of a hymn that says, "Sealed of God within the forehead, consecrated heart and soul, separate from sinners, wanton, yielding to the Lord's control, robes of righteousness possessing, first fruits they of harvest whole."